ESPN College Football Podcast.
Welcome into the ESPN College Football Podcast for Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. Exciting times in college football as we get closer to the 2022 season. Plenty of news to discuss, including a major recruiting story. We'll get to that a little bit later in the show. I'm Adam Rittenberg, joined by my friend and colleague, Paolo Getty, back from the U.S. Open in Massachusetts. And we'll get to some golf maybe a little bit later on. But Paolo is focused on football, and so is the man that is joining us now. Oregon head coach Dan Lanning joins us on the podcast heading into his first season. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. And just wanted to get your sense of what it's like right now. You know, we're kind of in late June. You know, preseason camp is somewhat on the horizon, and your first season, your head coaching debut against your former team in Georgia isn't that far away. What are things like right now for you and Eugene as you kind of navigate this period before preseason?
Yeah, it's been a ton of fun. Our guys are hard at work. You know, some are in summer classes right now, but every one of them's working hard in the weight room and out on the field. Really just getting prepared for that first game. I think our guys are anxious to go play, but also aware that there's a lot of work between now and that first game, even as it approaches. So hard at work, keeping it going and enjoying this process.
Dan, I'm curious, you know, first time head coaches, obviously there's a lot you're walking into, but in terms of just, you were at a place before that was doing it at such a high level. What's the balance like between bringing over some of those things from Georgia that succeeded so well and also kind of starting from scratch and to a sense in Oregon and seeing what you have there? What's the balance between what you have there and what you're bringing to the table from the other, from your other program?
Yeah, you know, I think this really goes all the way back to my starting off as a high school coach. And every year you start off fresh and you feel like you have to really adapt to the personnel that you have and the strengths of your team that you have. But I've been fortunate enough to be around a lot of new starts, you know, a lot of new programs as they, you know, came up, whether it be, you know, with Todd Graham or Mike Norvell or Casey Keeler, a lot of first year programs and seeing that transition. And obviously my experience with Coach Smart and Coach Saban, those obviously apply to this scenario as well. You know, you bring a lot of those thoughts that you like, and then there's some notes that you made while you were sitting in the captain's seat or the assistant's chair that you're like, hey, we're going to do this a little bit different. But I think you have to make it work for where you're at. And I've been really excited, you know, about the buy-in from our players, the direction of where we're headed, but also acknowledge that we're not Georgia. We're a different team than that. We have to be the best version of Oregon for us to excel this season.
Yeah, I'm wondering, kind of following up on that, how much do players want to hear about a previous place? I mean, you know, you were coordinator of one of the greatest defenses we've seen in college football last year and played out in the NFL draft. But, you know, do your Oregon players want to hear about those guys or what you did there? Or do you have to kind of balance how much you bring into the conversation with, hey, we don't care about that. We're at Oregon. We're focused on what we're doing going forward.
Yeah, it's a combination. I mean, I think you lean on the experience that you have, but this story isn't about Georgia. This story is about Oregon. So it's really both, Adam. I mean, you lean on what you've done as a coach and your experiences with players and how they've grown. But at the same time, this story is moving forward, and this story is certainly about Oregon. It's not about Georgia or any other stop that I've been on.
What's maybe one thing that has surprised you in terms of, okay, you know, debuting as a head coach, things you have to handle that you weren't handling before or dealing with before? What's maybe one thing that's surprised you or that you found, you know, as something you weren't expecting in terms of the process of acclimating to being a first-time head coach?
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. You know, I think, you know, time management is a key, you know, is a really big key. And I think you realize your time is not all your own. Your time is spread between a lot of different people. But I feel like I got to sit in a situation where I watched Coach Smart and several of the coaches that I've been with over the last, you know, several years manage that really well. So it wasn't something I wasn't necessarily prepared for. But, you know, there's times where I'd love to just, you know, throw up the film and grab the clicker and watch football, and that's not always possible. There's a lot of other hats that you're wearing. But when you hire good people, you're really detailed about what you want the organization to operate like. I think that allows you to do more of those opportunities.
Dan, you've been around your team now for about 6 months. You may not have an answer yet, but what type of team do you think you'll have in 2022 in terms of its strengths, its personality, areas that you still want to develop? You know, do you have that prediction or sense of what you're going to have when you guys actually start playing games?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that really carries over is our guys love ball. there's a lot of passion when we take the field, and we, this has been a joyful environment where our guys enjoy going out to practice. They enjoy going out to work. It's not a, that's not a strain. It's not a stress for them. They like stepping on the practice field and getting better. You know, I'm looking for a team that's connected, you know, a team that operates with a growth mindset, where we are looking for opportunities for growth. Even when we fail, it's an opportunity to get better. You know, and ultimately, we want to be a tough team that's willing to sacrifice for each other. It's putting the team in front of, you know, themselves. And I think a lot of those characteristics are starting to show through, but we certainly still have a lot of room to grow.
Not to deviate too far away from football, but I'm curious for you in the transition from a personal and logistical standpoint of going from Georgia to the Pacific Northwest. What's that been like just for you and your family? What's the acclimation process been like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely loving the Pacific Northwest. It's beautiful. I'll say this, you know, when I'd walk outside at Georgia, my shirt would immediately turn wet because of the humidity. And here I'm not experiencing that. You know, the fresh air, the climate is something I'm really enjoying. And yeah, just the change of scenery for me and my family, I think it's been a lot of fun. Our boys are really enjoying it. My wife, Sophia, is really enjoying it. So that's been a blessing.
Yeah, Dan, I think what's so interesting about your background is that you're not tied to one region. I mean, grew up obviously in Kansas City area, went to school around there, but you've been in the desert in Arizona, you've been in Pittsburgh, you've been in Alabama and Georgia. How has that prepared you for this role, especially, you know, kind of given Oregon's reputation that, you know, they're not tied to traditions necessarily, and obviously prideful of the location there, but how has your actual path prepared you for coaching this particular program?
Well, you know, one of the most unique, you know, attributes to Oregon, at least, is that we have a brand that speaks nationally. You know, it really travels. It's well recognized everywhere you go. And I think my experience being in a lot of different regions as a coach has been appealing because there's a lot of people that I'm connected to and our coaching staff's connected to throughout the nation and the world, where we were able to carry that brand. You know, so that was certainly a positive. I also think you coming out here to the West Coast, it's different. There's some things that are different about where I've been. So the fact that I've been out here at Arizona in the past is certainly, you know, a benefit to that experience.
Kind of speaking to that national conversation, the brand, you know, there's been a lot of talk this offseason about, you know, another program in the Pac-12 and all they've been doing. Has it been kind of, I don't know, beneficial into a certain extent to not have such a big, you know, magnifying glass on what you guys are doing, or sort of like so much attention on, you know, what's going on up there when there seems to be a lot of chatter about, you know, a team in Southern California?
You know, I think it's good for college football when college football is exciting. And I'm glad that, you know, this conference provides a great product and it's continuing to grow and get better and better. But certainly here, we're focused on the opinions of the people here in this building. In this place, and focus on what we can do better and don't spend a lot of time talking about or worrying about other programs outside of here.
When you look in the Pac-12, how much time have you spent, given everything else you've had to do on your plate since you got the job, just studying other Pac-12 programs, the brand of football? There's, you're not the only new coach in the league. Obviously, Coach Riley and Coach DeBoer at Washington. What do you sense you're going to be walking into just as far as this league and maybe how it's different from what the things you saw in the SEC?
Yeah, I'm excited. It's going to be a tremendous challenge. There's some, you know, some really well-respected coaches, obviously, in this league and programs that have been doing it at a high level for a long time. I think this conference is only get better. It's really diverse. You know, I think at times people look at the Pac-12 and they think 10 years ago about how much of a passing, how the game was spread out, you know, and really, if you look, every university in this conference is really distinctly different, and you have to have a new game plan, a new philosophy every single week when you walk into a game. So getting to watch more of that film, seeing how these coaches, you know, interact with their teams has been really fun to watch.
You being a defensive coach and coming from that background, I'm curious what's it been like to approach the offensive side of the ball and be more of a involved in those conversations, especially, you know, in a place like Oregon that has had in the past, like you said, that kind of explosive and fiery offense.
Yeah, ultimately, we know that wins are attributed to explosive plays and takeaways, right? That's where it starts. And we want to be an explosive, you know, team on offense that takes care of the ball. And I think it's been fun, you know, at least for me, to step in that room on the other side of the ball and just give them some of the things that I see. On the same note, I want our coaches to be creative and, you know, have the opportunity to grow. But I'm able to speak to a lot of things that caused issues for me over the years. you know, on that side of the ball. And I've enjoyed seeing our coaches take those wrinkles and, you know, carry them forward, you know, to our offense as we build that. But obviously being one that is able to extend the ball down the field, you know, work every piece of grass, and then obviously still have that tough mindset where you set your jaw and you're able to run the ball on fourth and one when you need a tough yard. That's really important.
Dan, we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of NIL, and you know, you experienced kind of the first half as an assistant coach at Georgia and then the second half as a head coach at Oregon. Obviously a very recognizable brand. You mentioned the national nature of Oregon football. How has how have you kind of observed NIL in the year that it's been in existence, and then especially the last 6 months? How has your strategy at Oregon evolved with respect to that, and not knowing necessarily how it's going to be going forward?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think ultimately one thing we all have to be prepared for as NIL continues to grow is change. And if anything over the last 12 months has been proven, you know, change is inevitable. It's going to continue to happen. And where, you know, I'm really excited about Oregon is how, you know, we've been ahead of the curve when it comes to creating opportunities and making sure our players are able to create opportunities for themselves through the name, image, likeness world. You know, Oregon has been on the cutting edge, just like we've been on the cutting edge in the last 15 years. That continues to be the case from this standpoint. I'm excited that our players have the opportunity to benefit and learn how to be professionals outside of just football and student athletes, but, you know, as a business person, you know, and that's growing and going to continue to grow here at Oregon. But the innovation that's taken place here, that continues to take place here as we continue to navigate this world, I'm really happy with the side that we're on, and we're not being reactive but proactive in our approach.
Between, you know, NIL and the portal, you know, what's it meant for you as a coach on a day-to-day basis? You know, is there more care being put into specific areas, more work maybe in general? What's that look like for you as a coach on that side of the ball?
You know, I think at the end of the day, one thing that's really taken place is all coaches have a great awareness of not just the kids that they're recruiting per se, but their own team, right? The players that are on their team. And I think if you're the two things we really focused on when we hired our coaches here at Oregon was relationships and development. And if you're truly a relationship driven person, you know, you're going to notice that you're not going to end up losing a lot of guys that you want to keep around. You're going to be able to maintain those positive relationships. Now, that being said, this is going to continue to change, continue to adapt. But if you can focus, if anything, NIL and the transfer portal has really brought an awareness into being tied in to your players, really focused on your players, on your team, which ultimately as a coach, that's where your focus should be.
Dan, I just want to ask you about one of your players, Noah Sewell. And, you know, you've obviously seen college players at the highest level on that side of the ball. But what do you sense is in store for Noah, you know, given what he did last year? Obviously has great bloodlines. Where do you see his role for you in year one on the Oregon defense?
Well, you know, I have extremely high expectations for Noah, as a lot of people probably do in the nation. But the reality is none of us have higher expectations for Noah than Noah himself. He's motivated. He wants to be great. He knows he's got room to grow. And that to me is exciting. But I'm certainly excited to see what he does in this defense. I know he's a great fit for where we're trending and where we're headed. And I'm also excited to see some of these other guys around him, because I know he knows he can't do it on his own.
Dan, I'm curious a little bit about the quarterbacks. You know, what's it been like to be working with Bo Nix, and also what have you seen from Ty Thompson as well in terms of the development that he's had, and how do you view, you know, the battle, if we want to call it that way, or the matchup heading into the fall?
Yes, you know, it's funny. We have a development group right now on our team that are talking through things, and this was a fun topic of conversation. I was listening to Bo and Ty really talk about each other the other day, and how impactful having both those guys and Jay included on our team as we grow at quarterback. And as you know, a lot of times, you know, people coming in can divide a team, and all this has done is strengthen our room and strengthen our team by enhancing that room. I'm super excited about the competition. You're talking about three really intelligent guys that have arm talent that we can win ball games with. And ultimately, what do you want? You want a guy at quarterback that you can win with. And I think we have that with Ty, Bo, and Jay.
And just last thing, when you and I first visited in February, I think you had just gotten off of a big Zoom call with a bunch of the alumni there at Oregon. I'm wondering how much you've been able to interact with them since, and what's that been like as you've tried to connect with them? Another coach coming in from the outside. I know they want you to stay and they want you to have success and win championships. What has that relationship been like to build over the last 5 months?
Yeah, I've been really happy, you know, to be able to be tied into our alumni. And there certainly aren't enough hours in the day to connect enough. But, you know, the group of guys that we had come to our spring game made such a big impact, not just for our program, but I hope it was impactful for them. Continue to look for that to grow. There's been conversation since and a lot of interaction since with a lot of guys. So I feel like our alumni feel welcome to come back and be a part of this program. And the reality is they built it, so they should. So I'm happy with where we're at with that interaction, but look for it to continue to grow and build upon it.
Dan Lanning, Oregon first year head coach. Dan, and hope you get some summer here to enjoy. And we certainly appreciate you joining us on the ESPN College Football Podcast.
Thanks, Adam. Appreciate you guys.
Before we move on, big news over here at ESPN Podcasts. ESPN has partnered with Peyton Manning's Omaha production to create a bunch of new shows. One of those shows is Courtside Club. Grab your popcorn and sit courtside with host and influencer Rachel DeMita as she chats with the biggest athletes, celebrities, influencers, and creative minds. Rachel and her guests dive into sports, pop culture, and the life experiences that forged who they are. That's Courtside Club. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Great stuff there with Dan Lanning, and I think the scheduling gods had a little fun with him that his first game will be against Georgia, obviously in Atlanta, a tough one right off the bat for the Ducks. But I think he's a really interesting hire, Paulo, and I'm fascinated to see, you know, how he recruits, how he develops, and whether he can keep up with Lincoln Riley and everything that you kind of hinted at that in your question to him. What did you kind of take away from the conversation just in regards to how he's building the team at Oregon, and what are some of the things that you're most interested in watching in his first season with the Ducks?
Yeah, I mean, obviously every program is different and some of them, you know, attract different attention, but it is interesting to me that, you know, in contrast to USC, where there's been just a lot of attention, a lot of chatter, seems like Oregon's kind of going about their own business very, you know, kind of methodically and almost quietly to a certain extent. And I think it'll be interesting to see, say, 3 to 5 years from now, which program had the better results. You know, there's obviously a lot of talent on both teams. And, you know, I think for the Pac-12 as a whole, that's one thing I'm fascinated by, is seeing how the conference can be improved from a national perspective if both of these teams play to the level of their talent, right? If they're having battles in the Pac-12 championship between Oregon and USC, that I think that would be huge for the Pac-12. And it'll be interesting to see whether they can both kind of match that level. You know, they got a lot of hype, I guess, around both teams, different type of hype in some ways. But yeah, I'm fascinated to see where Oregon goes, especially after, you know, switching out a few coaches here and there the last few years.
I do wonder, especially going forward in the Pac-12, I think we can agree that USC is going to be the offensive school in the conference. You know, Lincoln Riley, you know, Caleb Williams for at least 2 years, whatever quarterbacks come after him. We've seen their ability to attract transfers with Jordan Addison and others, and they're obviously going to recruit well on offense. Will Oregon potentially be the defensive program of record going forward? You know, Utah has been that at times. Washington's been really good defensively, not very good offensively lately, but I think they'll improve there under Kalen DeBoer. And not to say that Oregon, like you said, they have great history on offense and they've lit it up before. But I do wonder if Dan Lanning can give them an edge on defense over USC and maybe over the entire Pac-12 going forward.
Yeah, I mean, they have all the makings of being that kind of contrast to USC, right? Being that defensive powerhouse. I mean, they have a defensive coach in Dan, and just the way that he seems to be wanting to set up their program, I'm sure is going to be bringing some of that SEC pedigree to a Pac-12 team, right? And they do have talent on the offensive side of the ball. I'm really intrigued to see what Ty Thompson does this year or the next. And so I think they'll be able to match USC on both sides of the ball. But yeah, USC right now needs a lot of work on the defensive side of the ball. And so it makes sense to me. Like if we're just looking at this coming year, it would be a fascinating, you know, kind of study to see the contrast between both teams and how they match up against each other. And maybe we'll get it in a potential Pac-12 title game.
Dan mentioned that Oregon was ahead of the game with NIL, and it seems kind of obvious given their relationship with Nike and the way they've branded themselves. But you know, how do you think their NIL approach will evolve from here? And again, we don't know exactly how NIL will look even in the next year or so, but where do you see Oregon fitting into that with Dan at the helm and Phil Knight, who obviously wants to win a national championship, and their connection to Nike and other outlets, because they seem to do pretty well with it last year with Kayvon Thibodeau and others. But now you have a new coach, and what do you think is in store regarding NIL in Oregon?
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how exactly they utilize, you know, kind of what they've already established, because to a certain extent, Dan's right. Like, you know, Oregon became the cool program right before that was even like a factor in the NIL race, right, of branding and of marketing and all that. Like, Oregon was already kind of doing some of those things with uniforms. So now I feel like they can even expand that even more. And obviously, you know, we know Phil Knight's involved in that. And I don't know. I mean, I think they'll have to really tap into those resources, because the rest, specifically with USC, it seems like they're setting up as well with the new program they announced in terms of NIL, where they're not doing a collective, but they're doing this partnership, right? And you know, I'm not sure if Oregon has announced anything in along those lines, but it is going to be an arms race, and it does feel like they have an edge, like you said, just with Nike being there. I'm curious to see how the bigger brands decide to invest in NIL, you know, and over the long term, because it seems like we're slowly getting more bigger brands kind of dipping your toes into, like, specifically the college football NIL space. So, you know, if Nike gets involved, if other brands, big brands get involved, like, where does that lead? Where does that go? Does Oregon get a tangible advantage by being, you know, close to Nike and having those relationships?
You know, you live in California, Southern California. I grew up in Northern California, and we both know how rich that state is with high school talent. And we can talk about, well, participation numbers are down. It's not what it used to be. There's still a ton of great players in the state of California, and a lot of them have left the Pac-12 to go elsewhere. Just look at, you know, the reigning Heisman Trophy winner and the projected a guy that a lot of people think could win the Heisman next year, talking about Alabama's Bryce Young and Ohio State's CJ Stroud. I'm curious, with landing in place, you know, having spent some time in Arizona, I know his offensive coordinator, Kenny Dillingham's an Arizona native and has recruited that state forever, as well as Vegas. You got Tosh Lupoy on the staff, Adrian Clem on the staff. Combined with what you have at USC, how does the West Coast recruiting landscape change given these two new staffs? Are you still going to see Alabama and Ohio State and Clemson plucking really good players out of California? Or is there a likelihood that you could see the Pac-12, which I think is critical, locking down that state and having the best players go to USC, Oregon, Washington, whatever Pac-12 school you want to choose?
It does feel like we're about to turn a corner in the California recruiting space, where USC is going to start getting some of the guys they've been missing out on, you know, like Malachi Nelson, you know, name your player, right? And just because Lincoln Riley's presence there is so valuable, and also I think, you know, if they succeed, then it's just going to build on itself. I do think, like you said earlier, like, there's so much talent in the state that I feel like you're still going to be seeing, you know, Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, those programs come in here and pluck a few guys. But maybe where it changes is in those top guys, right? And you know, maybe a Bryce Young stays at USC or stays in California in the future, you know. And I think that's where you're going to start to see the differences, is some of the top guys are going to be sticking around a little bit, because, you know, somebody once put it to me, like, all these kids, they grow up wanting to play for USC. So it's more of like the circumstances that lead to them not going to USC is what's been, you know, the past few years. But now that there's some stability there and some promise, it's going to be a lot easier for kids to be like, yeah, I'm going to stay home to the program that I wanted to play for since I was a kid.
Yeah, no doubt. I think it's the biggest thing for the Pac-12 going forward, you know, along with obviously media rights and making money, is to try to do better with the elite players on the West Coast, particularly in California and Arizona. But there was recruiting news today from a former USC head coach, former Pac-12 coach, that is the biggest story in college football, and it probably will be for the next few days. And that's Arch Manning, the next in line of the Manning quarterback crew, announcing his commitment to the University of Texas and Steve Sarkisian, which is just enormous news for Sark and for the Texas program going forward. You know, he picked Texas over Georgia and Alabama, a couple other schools, LSU, Clemson, Virginia, also in the mix. But it was really what I'd heard down to Texas and Georgia, and several coaches as recently as Monday were telling me they thought he'd go to Georgia. So this is enormous for Hookham and for Sark and for the future of Texas, which is going to be in the SEC. So Arch will play SEC football just like his grandfather, his namesake, and certainly his famous uncles, Peyton and Eli, but he's going to do it at the University of Texas. Apollo, what was your reaction when you found out that he was going to commit to Texas, or he had committed to Texas, and that's going to be the next chapter in this incredible Manning quarterback legacy?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, to think that he was down to the team that just won the national title and Texas, he picked Texas, like that's whatever you want to say about them, whatever, whether you want to say that they're back or not back or whatever you want to, you know, criticize or earn it. That's a huge win for them. That's a huge win for Sark, which, you know, maybe we can get to Sark later because I'm fascinated by his whole, you know, story arc. But yeah, I think that's huge. I mean, I do wonder, you know, if had Texas not made the move to the SEC or not made the future move to the SEC, does Arch Manning end up there, right? Like that's something I was curious about. Is that such a big factor that he gets to play in the SEC, gets to play against the top competition eventually, that pushed him over there, you know, where he can kind of have the best of both worlds, be Texas next quarterback savior while also playing for the SEC. That's an interesting thing to me, just like thinking about it in the grand scheme, because you know, at the end of the day, you know, he probably could have gone to a better football situation if he wanted to, but he decided to choose Texas, and that's huge for them.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Just reading from our colleague Pete Thamel's story, you know, he talked with Nelson Stewart, Arch Manning's high school coach down in Louisiana, and you know, he described Arch as having an old school 1970s type recruitment in the sense that, you know, he wasn't on social media. He actually created a Twitter account to announce his commitment with his very first tweet today on a verified account. And so you know, it didn't seem like a guy that necessarily would have been won over by the flash. He obviously grew up in a family that you know, he's used to the attention, especially when he became a big time player. And in that sense, it makes Texas even more of an interesting choice to me, Paulo, because it feels like Texas has always had that brand power. They've always been a top five brand, even though they haven't been a top five program very often in the last, you know, 10, 12 years. And so, you know, you bring up Sark, you know, why do you think Sark was able to get Arch Manning? You're reading the quote here from Nelson Stewart on ESPN.com about Sark. He says, Sark, besides being a genius in the pass game and second to none in football acumen and offensive ideology, he's a good person. He and A.J. Milwee, the quarterback's coach at Texas, formed their own relationships. They really took the time to really recruit him, meaning Arch. I was able to see it firsthand. So what are we supposed to take away from this about Steve Sarkisian and Texas being able to get a guy who's projected as the number one player in his class, but also a player that didn't necessarily want the flash and the attention and going crazy on social media with edits and videos and so forth?
Yeah, no, I can't imagine how different or how unique maybe the process of recruiting him was. Like, that seems like a totally different experience, right? And I mean, personally, from a personal vantage point, I had a front row seat to how it all kind of went down for Sark at USC. I was a student there covering the team. And to think that this is where he's at now, where he's coaching Texas and getting Arch Manning, it's honestly like a little unbelievable for me to see just the way it's played out. But at the same time, all that makes me say is like, he's clearly doing something right. Like there's clearly a reason why he was hired again as a coordinator and then eventually hired again as a, you know, as a head coach. And the results so far have not necessarily been, you know, what was expected maybe of Texas. But at the same time, the fact that he's put the right team around him, the right, you know, coordinators and recruiting coordinators and all that, to be able to get a guy like this and know what exactly he needed to do to get Arch Manning, that's you can do nothing but you know praise that, because it was probably not an easy process, right? And the fact that they got him is a testament to, I think, less the brand, like you said, because that's not something that Arch seems to be interested in, but more about the substance of the school. At the same time, I do think, you know, if he would have gone to a Georgia, for example, he becomes a part of the program, right? A part of what Georgia's building. Whereas if he goes to Texas, it's almost like he's bigger than the program a little bit. And I know it's hard to say because it's Texas, it's just a huge brand, but it does feel like he's going to be like the marquee name there. Whereas with Georgia, he could have just been the Georgia quarterback, if that makes sense.
That's a great point. And, you know, I think that Texas has that nature because of how it markets itself and where it's located. And even in, you know, the fact that Sark hasn't had success yet as a head coach there, and may not this year, and we'll get to this year in a minute, but it is really interesting to think about what it will be like when Arch sets foot on campus to play next year, whether Texas is, you know, I assume they'll still be in the Big 12 in 2023, but could be transitioning to the SEC as early as 2024. But I think it does remind us, and you know this better than most, being a, you know, USC student and seeing, you know, Sark's career there, but it just, we forget how many great quarterbacks Sark has worked with and developed and made into superstars. You know, Mac Jones, the latest one at Alabama before he took the Texas job, but so many at USC before that, where he really built his reputation as an offensive coordinator and then even as a head coach. And so I think it's just a reminder that we're so quick to label Lincoln Riley the number one quarterback guy, or what Ryan Day has done at Ohio State, which again is remarkable, especially given their history as not an elite quarterback program, or what Nick Saban has done with multiple coordinators. Sark is a dude. Sark is, when it comes to quarterbacks, he is absolutely a dude, and he reminded us of that with the news today of Arch Manning.
Right. I mean, it almost makes you wonder if that's more of the job for him as opposed to like handling a program of this magnitude, right? Because he's been so successful at, like you said, developing these quarterbacks and being in that position, that you wonder if, like, you know, how is he going to extrapolate that into a CEO job, right? Which is essentially what he's having to do at Texas. And, you know, I guess only time will tell whether the product shows itself there.
Yeah, it will. And I think the fascinating part about this story on multiple levels is the fact that, you know, Arch Manning will not be playing at Texas this year, and there will be a season that Sark will coach, and coming off of a 5-7 year and having a really unique quarterback picture to sort out. And I want to ask you about that because, you know, by the way, Quinn Ewers is on campus with Texas. He was the number one recruit in his class, you know, transferred in from Ohio State. Hudson Card is still there, they obviously have other quarterbacks that want to get on the field at Texas in the near future. How do you think that quarterback room evolves, depending on what happens this season, with the knowledge that barring some type of change, Arch Manning will be arriving next year with the full expectation of starting either in 2023 or soon thereafter in his college career?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting glimpse into just the larger college football world as a whole, just in terms of the musical chairs that are happening at positions, at programs with the transfer portal and NIL. Like, this right here is exactly, it's almost like a small microcosm of everything, right? Because Quinn Ewers is there, transfer from Ohio State after getting some NIL deals there, but never playing. And, you know, now they got the biggest recruit in Arch Manning, but there's also other quarterbacks that who actually have played already and have done well and had some card. And so it's almost like, just like the coaches probably like Dan was saying earlier, like you almost have to worry about your own guys and re-recruit almost. Like, I feel like the players are also facing the reality that wherever they go, there's probably somebody coming up behind them that will make their job a lot harder, right? And I think for Texas specifically, I mean, when Arch gets there in 2023, if Ewers is still there and he struggles during one quarter, there will already be chance for Arch to come in. Like, it's almost an unwinnable situation for somebody like Ewers. And, you know, you wonder if he's just going to end up transferring again. It's hard. It's very easy to see a scenario where, you know, Quinn Ewers ends up, you know, on another team after Texas, or after a year at Texas, because he sees that there's not like a long-term plan there for him. And I don't know how the coaches balance all of that, but it's going to be fascinating to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think if Arch Manning is coming in expecting to sit and learn, and that, you know, gives, you know, Quinn Ewers or Hudson Card another year on the field, I mean, they can go on to the NFL, they can obviously transfer, but this seems to be shaping up to be a really interesting logjam because of who these players are, how much hype there has been. I mean, there's a lot of coaches I've talked to, Apollo, that think Hudson Card's going to win this job. And, you know, there may be a lot of pressure or maybe there was a lot of pressure on Sark to play Quinn Ewers. But I want to ask you, how does that pressure change or maybe decrease now that everybody around Texas knows that, yeah, I mean, sure, they want to have success this season. They don't want to lose to Kansas at home. They would like to have a winning record. They'd like to get to a bowl game. They'd like to compete for a Big 12 title. But Arch Manning's coming in 2023 either way, and that's clearly their future as they transition to the SEC. So I guess my question is, how much does this season matter for Texas, and how much pressure is on Steve Sarkisian? How much less pressure is on him this year?
I think getting Arch was probably the equivalent of a 10-win season at this point, because he just kind of gets it off. It's almost like a, you know, it's like a vacation season almost. Like, there's no way that they're going to, I mean, you know, if they lose every game, you know, then the conversation changes. But I think at this point, like, it's almost like, okay, this is just like a fun season to just see what happens and see what we have in other players and, you know, see what you have in yours to a certain extent, right? And then just, you know, everybody knows Arch is coming. Like, that's going to be the entire team, I feel like, of the season. They're going to want to succeed, but at the end of the day, what's that actually going to mean if they know that, you know, everything is going to change once Arch Manning arrives? And so I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. I think that's a great point. Like, it's almost like the pressure's off. This is just let's just figure out what we have season and wait until Arch gets there.
So last thing on this, Paulo, right now Texas has 5 ESPN 300 commits for the 2023 class, obviously headlined by Arch Manning, number one overall player. How does this impact what this class could become for Sark in terms of other players coming in and joining Arch in the class? But also, you look at the transfer portal, which Texas has benefited from on offense, Isaiah Nair and others transferring in this offseason. How does that impact them for the 2023-2024 season, you know, knowing that Arch Manning is there and that the SEC move is coming?
Yeah, I think that's been something I've been kind of watching ever since Caleb Williams ended up at USC and essentially brought along Jordan Addison with him, is, you know, the power of these quarterbacks, right? The power of these superstar quarterbacks in an NIL transfer portal age. What does that look like? How does that play out? And I think there's no doubt going to be, you know, handful of guys wanting to follow Arch to Texas now. I mean, he just made Texas, like, Texas was still probably cool, right, to a large swath of players, but he just made them, you know, attractive again in a lot of different ways. So I think you're probably going to have some flips to Texas. You're probably going to have some transfer additions to Texas, you know, all building up towards, you know, everybody's going to want to get a piece of this Arch Manning situation. And I think that's the reality. And, like, just kind of like how it feels like everybody's going to wanting to get a piece right now, Lincoln Riley and Caleb Williams and BUC, I feel like you're going to get a similar effect, because you're starting to have these quarterbacks who have these outsized talent and outsized personas and are able to attract people to them. And that's something I'm fascinated to see how it develops in the next few years. You know, you're already having players recruit other players in some ways, but this is like, it feels like now in this age, that's going to be even highlighted even more, is when these quarterbacks go to these places and what kind of movement they can set in place that brings even more talent to a program.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It feels like this has almost become an annual exercise where we just go nuts over a quarterback recruit. And obviously Arch Manning is unique because of the Manning name and what he did in high school and how he's being projected. But I feel like we had Andrew Luck, and then there was sort of a gap, and now it's like Quinn Ewers, Arch Manning, and there'll be somebody else obviously in the future. So it'll be really interesting to discuss, but obviously a huge day if you're a fan of the Texas Longhorns, and definitely a big day for one Steve Sarkisian and his coaching staff. So as we continue to get through the offseason here, Paulo, we're getting closer to media days and preseason camp. We're marking our progress going through the ABCs of college football. I've had the honor to do several of these letters, and today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by the letter S. And there's quite a few teams that begin with S around the sport. I'll go through them real quick. San Diego State, San Jose State, SMU, South Alabama, South Carolina, South Florida, Southern Miss, Stanford, Stanford and Syracuse. So a lot of different directions we could go, but I want to start off with the Stanford Cardinal there in California, where you live, where I grew up. Kind of an interesting point in their program's history, because for a while they were the Pac-12 program of record under David Shaw. They were making Rose Bowls and challenging for playoff spots or BCS championship game spots. Never quite got there. You know, last year they were bad, and they haven't been the same, it seems like, in certain hallmark elements of their program, especially in terms of the power game, running the ball, being really great on the offensive line. We remember what they did with Christian McCaffrey and Bryce Love and Toby Gerhart. You can go on and on with their history under David Shaw and Jim Harbaugh running the ball, but that seems to be a bit of a concern defensively. They backslid quite a bit last year. What do you sense with Stanford? Are they going to be better this year? Are they going to be a factor in the Pac-12 North against Dan Lanning's team and others, or have they kind of slipped to maybe a middle of the pack Pac-12 program?
You have to imagine that last season was some sort of reckoning or some sort of wake-up call to, like, okay, we're not the Stanford of old anymore. And to a certain extent, like you mentioned, they kind of lost their identity, right? That they've lost some of the things that made them, you know, Stanford football. Like, you know, the line play is at the top of that list, you know, that kind of grit and hard-nosed football that they were known for. I mean, it was, you had teams like USC, teams like Oregon, fear going there, right? Because you were going to go up against a team that was going to be tougher, stronger, and would beat you down, right, into submission, basically, and have these, you know, 10 to 13 games. So I think they lost a little bit of that, it seems. And I don't know if that's, you know, lack of talent in those spaces, or is it lack of development? You know, what's happening there is kind of unclear, but I do think that they still know where to go, right? I mean, David Shaw's still there. He's still leading the team. And I think this season, I think for them, it can't be seen as like, okay, we got to get back to the top of where we were, but we got to build on just moving up a step, you know, moving up a little bit forward, because they don't fully have, I think, the talent there to get back to what they were known for as quickly, but they have the fundamentals. They should have the fundamentals, right, with David Shaw there. And so I think if they just kind of double back on the line play and just, like you said, the power running, then that'll take them a long way. I could see them being, you know, spoiler for a team in the North like Oregon in a particular matchup.
Yeah, I think if I'm a Stanford fan, I'm hoping that the hiring of Lincoln Riley in particular, maybe a lesser extent Dan Lanning and Kalen DeBoer, lights a fire under David Shaw, who makes a ton of money. He's done a great job. He's in no danger of getting fired. But you know, the program's gotten a little stale, and you could even say a little soft in recent years. And so I think you want Stanford to have its edge back, and maybe those hirings and the way that they're recruiting and some of the attention they're getting could get Stanford moving in the right direction. The other thing too, Paulo, I think Utah has kind of become Stanford. And that's a problem, is that when Utah is doing the things you used to do in terms of winning the line of scrimmage, playing really physical defense, you know, getting enough from the quarterback play, which hadn't been a great position always, although they've had some good quarterbacks under Kyle Whittingham. And you just look at the last two games against Utah, both at Stanford Stadium, one that I covered back in 2018, a 40-21 Utah win. And then, you know, maybe the most embarrassing game of David Shaw's career, Stanford's coach last year, 52-7. It was just a complete bulldozing, non-competitive performance by the Cardinal, and stunning for those of us who have seen what they've been. And so I think that's going to be really interesting to see, if they can get back to almost chasing Utah, and then also how programs like USC and Oregon affect Stanford going forward. Because just like you and I remember, those Stanford-Oregon games were wars. I mean, those were great games.
No, there was some of the best. And I think you're right. Like, Utah has kind of stole the Stanford identity here. And, it's probably no coincidence that we're talking about Utah going into the season as, you know, one of the Pac-12 favorites, because they have that foundation, that's, you know, that line play, that running back play. And they just feel like a well-oiled machine, right? Which was what we thought about Stanford. You know, they would just plug in the next running back, the next, you know, offensive tackle, and they would just, you know, go down the road and beat USC, beat Oregon. And so it'll be interesting to see what steps they take to kind of get back to that as well.
Another S team I wanted to get your thoughts on, Paulo, is South Carolina. And I think we'd all agree it was a very good, encouraging first season for Shane Beamer being back in Columbia. He'd been an assistant there. It's been his dream job. He made that very clear. And even though he was a little bit of a surprising hire to replace Will Muschamp, I think things have worked out well so far for Beamer as the Gamecocks head coach, 7-6 in his first season. And then they land another S, Spencer Rattler, the quarterback from Oklahoma, who transfers to South Carolina and is projected as their starter. You know, as encouraged as they were by 7-6 last season, they were outscored 230-167 in SEC play, went 3-5, and so they clearly need a boost on offense to compete in which I think is going to be a very tough SEC East division with the defending national champions in Georgia. You have a Kentucky team that continues to put up good seasons, went 10-3 last year, finished in the top 20. They get Will Levis back at quarterback, and they're always tough on defense. Tennessee took a major step forward offensively under Josh Heupel last year. They also went 7-6. And so where do you see South Carolina fitting in with Spencer Rattler as their quarterback, Shane Beamer second year as their head coach in a division with a new head coach of Florida and Billy Napier? And I think, again, Kentucky and Tennessee on the rise.
Yeah, the division outlook is tough for them, and it's almost you have to keep expectations tempered a little bit. But at the same time, I kind of love that, you know, that change of scenery that Spencer Rattler is getting. Like, you know, I used to cover the NBA, and we there was always a bunch of guys who you'd say, oh, well, they just need to change the scenery, and they'll reach their full potential. And I feel like to a certain extent, we might see that kind of season from Spencer Rattler, because there was definitely a reason why he was considered to be, you know, a Heisman candidate at some point. Like, there's definitely talent there. And I think Shane Beamer could definitely unlock some of that. And like you said, they really need just something on offense to get them back to the level. The defense had a ton of takeaways. I wonder if that'll regress a little bit, but if the offense kind of, you know, pulls up a little bit, then maybe they'll have something of a balanced team that could, to a certain extent, you know, maybe they'll spoil a few teams' runs. They'll get a few upsets here and there, but I think that the foundation is there to be a consistent team. You know, whether that translates to wins, given the division, given the matchups that they'll have to face, it's a whole other question. But I am excited to see how Rattler does in a different environment. I think that'll be one of the bigger storylines this season.
Yeah, it's a big time redemption story for Rattler. You're going to, you know, the top conference and a coach that he knows from Oklahoma after losing his job to Caleb Williams last year. It's going to be a really interesting team. I don't know if they'll be necessarily a great team, because they're going to have to bring it every week. But definitely a story that we'll watch. Just wrapping up the S's, Paul, I wanted to ask you about two really impressive Group of Five programs in this category. San Diego State, again, 12 wins last year. You know, they've won 10 or more games, I guess it's five times since the start of the 2015 season. Rocky Long did an outstanding job there, and then Brady Hoke, second time as the Aztecs head coach, leads them to a 12-2 and a top 25 finish. And then SMU again has really emerged in the American as a program of note. Sonny Dykes moves on to TCU. Rhett Lashley steps in, the Miami offensive coordinator who previously served as offensive coordinator under Sonny Dykes at SMU. They've done a great job of working the transfer portal and maximizing the fact that they're in Dallas and so many players want to bounce back to that area. What do you think about these two S's in the Group of Five and what's in store for them, San Diego State and SMU?
Yeah, I mean, it's been crazy to see, you know, obviously being sort of nearby to San Diego State, what that program has become. You know, I think Brady Hoke, I mean, we were talking about Sark earlier, but what a redemption story for Brady Hoke to kind of find himself in San Diego and putting out, you know, a great defensive team with, you know, great specialists, obviously Matt Araiza last year, you know, it speaks for himself. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how if at any point can Brady Hoke actually produce a top offensive team in the conference. I mean, defense has carried the day for them, and I think the running game has been pretty good, but you know, where do they go from here? You know, is there a ceiling there, or is there something they can keep building on? I am interested to see how San Diego State goes forward, but I think it's commendable just the kind of reputation and identity that they built for themselves under Brady Hoke. And you know, with SMU, I mean, I think you said it there. It's like the transfer portal, right? That's kind of what they have to rely on to a certain extent. They're not, you know, they're not Texas. They're not a big time program. They're probably not going to be pulling too many recruits too many top recruits. And, you know, getting a guy like Rick Lashley, I think, you know, the offense will be interesting to watch to see where they head. But Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting that Sonny Dykes, you know, opted to go to TCU just down the road. I think that says a lot about maybe what kind of resources they're working with in terms of, you know, how much they want to put into the football program. But at the end of the day, they've produced a pretty good program the last few years. And if, you know, if they keep tapping the right buttons of the transfer portal, I think SMU could be in the mix there as well.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the American in the future with Houston and UCF and Cincinnati all departing for the Big 12. SMU can be really the king of that conference potentially if it plays its cards right. And if there's another round of realignment, you know, maybe they get the call to the Big 12 or another power league. So really important period coming up. And I agree with you. They should be outstanding offensively. And, you know, Rhett has seen how Sonny built that program, so has a pretty good blueprint to reference. So that'll do it for the S's. Up next in our countdown is the letter T. We'll have plenty to discuss next week on the podcast. But want to thank Paolo Ughetti, obviously Oregon head coach Dan Lanning for joining us at a pretty busy time of year, even though it's late June. Obviously, producer Taylor, and wanted to thank you most of all for listening and downloading us. This has been the ESPN College Football Podcast.